Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The United States is the most dangerous place to give birth in the developed world. That was the finding of an investigation last summer by USA Today, which found that while most give birth without incident, 50,000 women are severely injured and 700 die due to problems in childbirth. An NPR ProPublica investigative series found similar results. While other countries are improving childbirth outcomes, the U.S. is the only country in the industrialized world where the rate of women who die from pregnancy-related complications is rising, more than doubling over the past two decades. These investigations found that hospitals are inadequately prepared to deal with maternal emergencies, and treatable complications can often become deadly. Why is this happening? It's a question we posed back in August to several experts, starting with Allison Young, the investigative reporter who worked on USA Today's Deadly Deliveries series. And I began by asking how the issue of maternal mortality came to her attention.
Well, the entire origins of this story began several years ago, and that's when one of the major organizations that accredits hospitals put out an alert to hospitals across the country about the rising rate of women dying from childbirth. And one of the things that was in their own report was that it appeared many of these deaths could be preventable with better medical care. And that really struck us as something that was pretty astounding, given that in our country we pride ourselves as having one of the greatest medical systems, and we certainly have one of the most expensive medical systems out there.
Yeah, the NPR ProPublica investigation, which kind of parallels yours, says that for every woman who dies in childbirth in this country, 70 more come close, and that women here die in childbirth at a far higher rate than in all other developed countries. Your investigation lays the blame for thousands of women suffering life-altering injuries and death in childbirth squarely at the feet of hospitals and medical workers. Talk about that.
Sure. And hospital and medical workers are not the only factor in all of this. But what the experts have found when they've dug into these deaths and these severe injuries is that, in general, in about half of the cases of women who have died, there were opportunities to save that woman's life if the medical professionals had recognized the signs and symptoms of, you know, the emerging disaster earlier and had used evidence-based best practices to save that woman's life. And the same thing is playing out for these near miss, these 50,000 women a year who suffer these severe complications.
And even more alarmingly, I think your report particularly concludes that using some relatively uncomplicated, inexpensive procedures and technology could save lives. One thing you point to is giving medication for higher than normal blood pressure within an hour of noticing it. The problem is people don't notice it for whatever reason. The other is the significant loss of blood, because hospitals sometimes don't know how much blood the woman has lost in childbirth. Why?
Both of these are areas that there have been studies, and it's one thing to have a study, but there have been practice guidelines issued by some of the leading medical organizations that whose members deliver babies. They have warned for years that when women's blood pressures exceed a certain danger level, that they are at risk of suffering strokes, and that these women need very rapid treatment with specific blood pressure-lowering drugs. And that has been out there for many years. It just isn't happening. And you know, one of the things that's unique about USA Today's investigation is we were able to obtain some very difficult to get numbers from hospitals in certain states. North Carolina is one of them, that showed how often it is that women who had crossed this danger threshold with blood pressure did not get treatment within 1 hour, which is what is considered to be the gold standard. And at some of the hospitals in North Carolina, we're talking the majority of women did not get those treatments in a timely fashion.
So your investigation calls this a stunning lack of attention to safety recommendations and a widespread failure to protect new mothers. But there is no national tracking system for this. You got reports. You went in and asked states to give you this information. Half of them reported back to you. That's how you uncovered this. Is that correct?
In a couple of ways. So we contacted 75 hospitals across the country, and we asked them very specific questions. Are you doing some of these recommended best practices? And only half of them would answer our questions. So, I mean, that's a problem to begin with for consumers. I mean, if you can't get basic information about whether or not a hospital is following safety practices, it makes it very difficult for consumers, if they have a choice as to where to give birth, to make that kind of choice.
Are hospitals themselves aware? Or are they ignorant of their own failings? Are they ignorant of best practices? Are they ignorant of the rising trend in this country versus all the other industrialized nations where childbirth is a dangerous prospect for women? Or are they just not aware of it because we don't have any central reporting system?
What USA Today's investigation found is that at the organization levels, the American Hospital Association, state hospital associations, often major hospital chains, there is very widespread awareness of both these safety practices and of the deadly trends in this country. One of the things USA Today reports on is audio tapes of national training sessions where they talk at length in somewhat secretive conferences about how so many of these deaths and harms are preventable if staff had done what they should do. But at the individual hospital level, there still are communication and training gaps that are part of the issue. And there are also bureaucratic barriers to giving the right kind of care.
So let's put this into perspective. It's kind of hard to do this without charts in front of you. This is radio, so I'll just have to explain it verbally, I suppose. The trend line, the failure to monitor and treat dangerous conditions from 1990 to 2015, while rates of maternal death in Germany went from 20 per 100,000 births to less than 10, as rates in France went from just over 17 per 100,000 births to fewer than 10, as rates in Japan and England declined, the rate in this country went from 17 per 100,000 to 26.4. Now, this information was published in the Lancet Medical Journal, so American medical practitioners were certainly aware of these numbers. Did that not send up red flags or cause changes in procedures and policies?
There has been widespread awareness of these trend lines. The CDC also has put out similar information, and that's part of the reason there was this alert sent out to hospitals several years ago. But one of the things experts told us is that changing medical practices can take a tremendously long time. There are some studies that say it can take 17 years from the time between when hospitals and medical providers know what to do and when they actually do it. And while that might be the norm in medicine, if you are one of these women who ends up having to have a hysterectomy and can no longer have children because your hemorrhage was not identified and treated properly early, 17 years being the norm is way too long.
Well, 17 years is almost two decades, and you report that for more than a decade, the experts who guide medical practices in the U.S. have been pushing doctors and hospitals to change how they treat pregnant women. Has there been a response? Are they in the middle of that response and just not quite at the goal line yet?
There is a growing movement across the country to get these hospitals to adopt what are called safety bundles. There is a program that is part of a coalition of all of these leading medical societies for women's health called the AIM program. And there are also certain state collaboratives, and North Carolina has one as well. And so there are hospitals at a growing rate signing up for these programs. But one of the things that the program operators will say is just because you sign up for a program doesn't mean you are actually implementing things. And there are some experts and consumer advocates who raise the question of, should this all still be a voluntary improvement effort, or should there be some requirements?
So as you said, you look through the records of dozens of hospitals in New York and Pennsylvania and the Carolinas for your articles. You write, at Carolina's Medical Center in Charlotte, nearly 40% of mothers did not receive timely blood pressure treatments. The failure rate was 78% at Carolina's healthcare system Northeast in Concord and nearly 90% at Stanley Regional Medical Center in Albemarle. These are all hospitals operated by Atrium. The internal information on which came from 2015 to 2016, on these hospitals, came from 2015 and 2016. They say that they have improved their practices since those records were taken. Have you been able to verify that?
No, we've not. And we asked them to share with us the individual hospitals' rates, what they are updated, and they would not do that. We also asked them to go through a list of questions with us about whether or not these hospitals are following specific practices recommended by the AIM program for preventing harms from hemorrhage and severe hypertension, two of the leading causes. They would not grant those interviews either.
Allison Young is an investigative reporter for USA Today and reported on that publication's Deadly Deliveries series last year. When we come back, we hear about what's being done locally to fix the problem. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening this hour to our August conversation about maternal mortality in the United States. We just heard about what USA Today uncovered in its investigation and what they found was happening in the Carolinas, particularly at Atrium Health facilities. And now we hear from Atrium and others. Dr. Saj Joy is Chief Medical Officer at Atrium Health Pineville. He's also an obstetrician gynecologist who specializes in high-risk maternal fetal medicine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Dr. Amelia Sutton, an obstetrician gynecologist in maternal and fetal medicine at Novant Health. She's also in our studio. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Sarah Verbeest is a clinical associate professor at UNC School of Social Work and the executive director of the Center for Maternal and Infant Health in the UNC School of Medicine in Chapel Hill. And she joins us by phone. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Dr. Joy, because we just talked about Carolina's healthcare system and some of the things that the USA Today report uncovered, and you took some notes. I watched you take notes over there. This data was from 2015 and 2016, and the hospital says improvements have been made. Were these improvements made in response to the USA Today study, to the NPR ProPublica study, or because hospitals are aware that we're not doing so well in relationship to other countries?
Well, I think I'll start by saying that in response to the article in particular, at Atrium Health, our highest priority is safety and well-being of our patients. Mm-hmm. And though the study looked at the HEN data within a period that you said is 2015, that data is essentially old, 3+ years essentially. And our primary goal, as it was stated in the article, and what the HEN collaborative wanted was to build a culture of continual improvement and develop and spread best practices. You know, one, we gathered the data. First part was finding out what the rates were, because as you had alluded to, there's no national database that's really reporting this. Some of this is retrospective. And when we found out that these were our rates at that time, what have we done about it? That's the question, right? And we at that time started adopting best practices. Even before that, we were already creating initiatives within our system to have quality and safety committees that looked at it from a system-wide perspective to adopt best practices. One, for example, we started quantifying blood loss, as has been described by other national organizations as a best practice approach. We implemented, as Allison alluded to, the AIM safety bundles for hemorrhage. So this was already in place. So, mm-hmm. You know, that's the challenge of having retrospective information.
Would you say things are improving?
Absolutely. You know, in addition to, I can answer that with data in just a second, but other types of things that we're doing are implementing the ACOG or best practice guidelines.
And this data is empirical, yeah. But you folks, Dr. Joy and you, Dr. Sutton, are OBGYNs.
Yeah.
You deal with patients. You deal with this every day of your lives. Anecdotally speaking, from what you have experienced mm-hmm. with your patients in your hospitals, have you seen these problems? Were you aware, even if you hadn't seen the data, that something was going awry, Dr. Sutton?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think I can speak for all obstetricians that our primary focus is patient safety, and we've all been working in the trenches for years and years in busy labor and delivery units. It's a difficult place to work. Emergencies can evolve over a matter of minutes. Mm-hmm. And so rapid response to these problems is tantamount to taking great care of our patients. And I can say that, you know, obstetric emergencies are well managed by the vast majority of obstetricians and hospital systems across the country and have been for many years. Of course, I think there is room for improvement, mm-hmm. as has been highlighted this morning already. And I think with these more standardized protocols and approaches, we have made great improvements.
I think this is pretty shocking to a lot of people because women have given birth since the beginning of time. And we would think that because our medical system is so advanced, mm-hmm. in the 21st century, particularly in this country, and because we pay so much more for it than any other country in the world, that we must have the best system. And this would be a rare occurrence. And in fact, it is a rare occurrence.
Thank you.
But the fact that it happens and the mm-hmm. fact that we are underperforming the rest of the industrialized world mm-hmm. is pretty damning. How can it be?
Well, let me just absolutely. How can it be that's a bigger, more complex problem to solve than, you know, is it all controllable? I think my approach to things and our approach is control what we can control. So if there are opportunities that are available to solve a problem in the acute care setting when a patient is having an emergency, make sure you have the systems in place to address it. And that's one of the strategies that we've implemented, and these bundles allow you to do that. But there are also many other contributors to maternal mortality within the U.S. compared to the rest of the world that really sometimes are getting pushed to the side and saying they don't matter as much.
So, Dr. Joy, you work at CHS in Pineville, and the USA Today report, fortunately for you, mentioned three different hospitals other than yours under the Atrium umbrella: CMC, the main system, Carolina's Healthcare System Northeast in Concord, and Carolina's Healthcare System Stanley in Albemarle. Mm-hmm. At CMC, it said 39% of women did not get proper care. The failure rate was 78% at the hospital in Concord, nearly 90% at the hospital in Stanley. Have all the procedures and protocols that led to that negative report there, have they been addressed? Have they been fixed? Could the same be said today, or would the numbers be completely different?
I think the numbers are already significantly different because we identified a problem and have implemented these other bundles and processes in place at each of the facilities. And even though I work at Pineville, we are looking at it and have looked at it from a system perspective. And in that, what I mean is that we have improved our administration of hypertensive medications within 60 minutes, mm-hmm. over the improvement of over 25% since this study came out. We've improved 57% the number of unplanned hysterectomies because of hemorrhage and so forth. So they are working, they're continuing to improve, and across the system.
I'm not sure why Novant wasn't included in the USA Today report. Maybe you dodged a bullet. Maybe maybe you didn't give records. I don't know. But if those records had been available to USA Today in that same time period, how would you have compared to Carolina's healthcare system?
I don't have hard and fast numbers for you at this time. I know that those are available, but I can say that we have been implementing safety bundles and initiatives over the last 3 to 4 years and have seen vast improvements in our numbers already.
So Sarah Verbeest is with us. She is a clinical associate professor at the UNC School of Social Work and executive director of the Center for Maternal and Infant Health at the UNC School of Medicine in Chapel Hill. Would you agree, Sarah, with the conclusion that USA Today arrived at, that the United States is the most dangerous place to give birth in the developed world? Is that a fair statement or is that exaggeration?
That's a good question. And I think, for me, overall, it's just disappointing when I think about all of the resources and training that we have in our country. We should be having the best birth outcomes in the globe. So kind of want to lift that up. I would like to introduce something to the conversation that wasn't mentioned previously that I think is critically important. And that's the fact that when we look at the women who are dying, we know that women of color are 3 to 4 times more likely to die than white women. And we've known for years we've had a gap in infant mortality. So black babies are 2.5 times more likely to die than white babies. So I guess it's not really surprising that black moms are more likely to die than white moms. But I think it's a significant issue that we need to have some conversation about. And I think the fact that we see our gap in infant mortality, that inequity has grown, also sort of makes me think that this trend is obviously real, as we've seen this gap in deaths for moms grow as well.
The statistic that you just gave about women of color and babies of color is alarming, and it begs the simple question, why?
I don't think we know.
Well, I think we have some ideas. Okay. I think that this is an example of the insidious impact of internalized, interpersonal, institutional, and historic racism. And I think that's a very, there's a lot of complexity to that. And it's something that the responsibility for that is shared widely, not just in hospital systems, for sure. I think that issues around paying attention to bias and improved patient-provider communication are also really important.
USA Today's study focused primarily on two specific conditions, the high blood pressure and significant loss of blood that went unnoticed. The NPR ProPublica series of reports on the same issue details other possible reasons and risk factors for this, and some of you have already mentioned these things, including women giving birth later in life, obesity at the time of birth, the greater use of C-sections, which bring on their own complications. And Dr. Sutton, despite the fact that these complications are rare, I want to stress that. I don't want to panic people. They still happen in this country more frequently than in other advanced nations. And the instance of mothers dying in childbirth here in this country is three times greater than a mother in Britain or a mother in Canada. How troubled are you by this? I mean, we're supposed to have the best system in the world. Truly, that's not true.
Absolutely. Of course, we're troubled by this. This is what I do every day, and it's unacceptable in this country that mothers are dying at this rate. It's up to all of us to fix it. So the burden lies just not with the healthcare system, but with all of us in this country.
How would you two, who work for different hospital systems in this region, compare the rate of mothers dying because of childbirth to the hospitals around the country? Are you better than average, at average, below average?
So the state of North Carolina has reported
we're below average, the state.
Below average at 12, in the range of 12 per 100,000, which is below average.
But how does Novant, how does Carolina's healthcare stack up to those numbers?
Well, it's difficult to give you numbers because this is a smaller portion, and this is the maternal mortality ratio is per 100,000.
But the hospitals themselves don't look at how you're doing in relationship to the rest of the country?
And it's quite low. The larger hospital systems obviously tend to have a lower mortality ratio.
Well, you got a big hospital system over there at Atrium. How do you compare to the rest of the state and to the rest of the nation?
I don't know if I can actually compare. I don't have that data readily available,
okay,
but I know that we are continuing to monitor it. And I think also from a statewide perspective that Allison, the reporter, alluded to, we do have statewide maternal mortality review committees that are looking at all maternal deaths, trying to find what the attributions were. Those committee members in North Carolina constitute of 9 members addressing each maternal mortality case and trying to find opportunities and strategies to improve upon, because not even one death is too many.
Sarah, part of the problems that USA Today reported on, Allison Young reported on, and her colleagues, had to do with lack of monitoring, doctors not knowing how much blood a woman had lost. Mm-hmm. And they've been taking corrective measures now to monitor that. Not knowing about how high a woman's blood pressure was, preeclampsia. You have called this failure to monitor and treat these conditions, Sarah, disappointing. Given how well other nations are performing on this in relationship to ours, wouldn't a better word be irresponsible, even criminal?
So I would like to take a minute and continue to broaden our conversation a little bit. I think it is really essential that we focus on providing the best quality care to all women who are receiving care in our hospitals. But I also want to point out that women are dying after they're discharged from hospitals as well. And we haven't talked a lot about women that are dying as a result of substance abuse, dying as a result of depression, anxiety.
Is that part of this? Would that explain the higher rate of this in America versus Germany or France or Canada?
So I don't have the data in front of me, but it's all part of why women are dying at increased rates. And I think if you looked at our larger healthcare system, when we look at what happens to women in our country after they have a baby, they're discharged from the hospital, and then the standard of care is generally for them to come back 6 weeks later for a visit. And we know that about 40% of women aren't coming back for that visit.
Well, let's talk about that, because one of the problems, one of the things that all nations that are involved in this study are involved in childbirth. All nations give C-sections. All nations have normal childbirth, et cetera. But we're the only nation among those nations that does not have universal health care.
Correct.
Right.
Is that the crux of the problem? Not enough prenatal health care, not enough follow-up after the birth, because women just don't have the money to see the doctor.
I think it's a huge contributor to what we're seeing. I think, more access to health care has been shown again and again to be able to improve outcomes for all health conditions. So I think that access to health care and contraception, importantly, is a huge contributor to what we're seeing in this country.
That's Dr. Amelia Sutton with Novant Health, who joined us in August to discuss America's maternal mortality problem. We're going to continue that conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. This hour, we're looking at America's alarmingly high rate of women who died during childbirth compared to the rest of the industrialized world. We were joined in the studio in August by Dr. Saj Joy with Atrium Health and Dr. Amelia Sutton with Novant Health. Both are OBGYNs. And Sarah Verbeest is Executive Director of the Center for Maternal and Infant Health at the UNC School of Medicine. During our conversation, we received this comment from a listener. Kaya on our website: I have three children, and my first two births were hospital births, and both times no one believed me when I told them I was about to deliver. I was left alone, and I told I was bad at labor. I'm African American, college educated. My story is not uncommon among women like me. For my final birth, I went a different route to a local birth center with certified nurse midwives in Charlotte. It was a completely different experience. I was believed and supported throughout the process. That's one thing that comes up in the one of these surveys, either USA Today or ProPublica, NPR, forgotten which, where women are not listened to and they're not believed. Why?
Two different responses to that. One would be that, yes, midwives take care of low-risk pregnancies, but as Dr. Sutton alluded to earlier, even a low-risk pregnancy has a probability of having a complication that can occur quickly. Mm-hmm. And low-risk pregnancies as a whole, whether delivered by an OBGYN or a midwife, tend to have good outcomes. And so this rarity would be even more rare in that situation, such as a severe morbidity or mortality. The second comment related to, do we listen to women as much as we should? Absolutely, you're correct. The data has shown that we don't pay as much attention. But I think that one other piece that we need to add in there is there are other comorbidities that are not being completely addressed here today. Because even though we talk about hemorrhage and hypertension and we're implementing strategies to improve that, those rates contributing to maternal mortality are reducing or have remained stable, versus those other things like cardiovascular disease or pre-existing illness being a larger contributor to why we end up with maternal mortalities.
How much of it has to also do with our fractured medical system in this country? We don't have any standard of necessarily mandatory standard of care that is handed down from on high. Hospitals and individual doctors sometimes have their own best practices because they've used them forever and ever. They work for them. And maybe those aren't the best practices. How much of it has to do with that?
So I think we all do follow some of our national guidelines, such as ACOG has issued multiple. There's a multitude of guidelines that most OBGYNs do follow. And so although they're not mandatory, that is considered best practice in our practice. And so we do tend to utilize those that have been vetted by experts in our field.
And some hospitals, Sarah, have begun to participate voluntarily in childbirth safety improvement program called AIM, which one of you alluded to, the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal, is it health?
Correct.
Okay. Why, Sarah, why is this voluntary? Why isn't some, why isn't the CDC or the National Institutes of Health or the Surgeon General or somebody said, this is what you will do?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think that it would be wonderful if this was something that were not optional and that it wasn't optional to also be sharing data. And perhaps we're going to go in that direction, which I think would be, I personally think would be a great direction to go. I do tip my hat to the hospitals in North Carolina that have committed the resources and the time to participate voluntarily. I do think it speaks to their desire to do better and to provide increased quality of care. And it would be wonderful if all the hospitals were engaged in that way.
Let me go back to something I quoted from your colleague at UNC School of Medicine, Allison Stubbe, who said that the baby is the candy, the mom is the wrapper, and once the candy is, once the wrapper is open, and the wrapper is discarded. In the break, Dr. Sutton said, Dr. Stubbe refers to postpartum care as the fourth trimester of care. And the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists have created guidelines for postpartum care for mothers. But you say, Sarah, that 60% of women never get any more care after childbirth. Why?
That's 40%.
Oh, 40. Even 40, so, why?
60%, I was being positive. 60% do get care. So there's a number of different reasons for that. I think part of it is that traditionally we've had a six-week postpartum visit. And so sometimes by the time women get to that point, they've kind of dealt with discomforts or gone back to work. And so I think we've missed the time when women may really be needing support, which I think is earlier. So some of it is how we've lined up our system of care and how we reach out to women and how we connect with them. Some things that we've also heard from women is that we haven't really had a lot of great standards for that postpartum visit. So in some cases, the visit hasn't given them a lot of value. And so when you're really busy with a new baby and maybe juggling other kids, women make a trade-off. Is that visit worth it to me? What I'm going to have to give up to get there? And we particularly see this when women are having to deal with transportation and childcare to get to that visit. And I think that ACOG is working to address that. They've put some new standards about what they think should be included in that postpartum visit. And then I think, finally, we do a very poor job of educating women about what to expect after they have a baby. It's that big movie moment. Here's your baby. You've given birth. Everyone's happy. And we don't talk about thinking ahead to having some plans in place for her care postpartum.
When you say we, who are you talking about?
So I use a global we. I definitely put responsibility squarely with our healthcare system, since they are the people that are having the most contact with women. But I think that also as a larger society and as a community, that we know that new families need more support than we're giving them in this country. I think a lot of our media has this expectation that after you have a baby, you're going to recover quickly, you're going to be happy, your family is going to be happy, you're going to be productive. And I think we don't really pay attention to how challenging it is to have a new baby. And so we kind of close the opportunity for conversations for women to have about feeling depressed, worried, anxious. And also we don't talk about the things that happen to our bodies after we have babies, like incontinence. And so I just think there's like a whole lot of conversations that need to be had. And I think that they can and should be kickstarted in prenatal care.
Traditionally, has this education process, both pre-birth and postpartum, has it fallen to the OBGYN?
The healthcare provider could be the OBGYN, could be their nursing team, could be the ACP or the midwife.
How would you grade yourselves on how you conduct those educational seminars, so to speak, individually with patients?
Well, I I would say that I personally learned most of what I know about postpartum care after I had my own children. So
really?
I'd say that coming from that perspective,
you're a doctor.
Exactly. So I thought, how terrible of a job am I doing educating patients? And I think that I've made, personally, great stride.
Does that put you at a significant disadvantage, Dr. Joy?
Not really. My wife told me to share the same type of information after we had our children and to reemphasize the importance of empowering the patient, not only during their prenatal care, but also postpartum, and really making sure that they're not neglected. And I've continued to do that.
One of you has said that insurance only covers X number of visits after the baby is delivered. How many do they cover? How many should they cover, in your opinions?
So unless there's a complication, they typically only cover the single postpartum visit.
And that would occur when?
6 to 8 weeks. Okay. And again, as Sarah alluded to, that is often too late to intervene if there's a complication or if there's other mood disorders that have arisen. And so the patient is trying to cart the baby to the pediatrician's office for all of those visits and neglecting her own health. And so I think improving access to those postpartum visits is really important.
And doctor, go ahead.
I'm sorry. And one implementation, both with this fourth trimester and the perinatal period of the first year after, the important piece that has been assigned is that you should have that visit, as Sarah alluded to, within the first 2 to 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. But for patients that are hypertensive, one of the other management guidelines is to have a visit with your OBGYN or at least your practice within 7 to 10 days after delivery, again, to try to focus in on and reduce that risk of hypertensive complications.
Does that happen, and is it covered by insurance?
Yes, it does, and I'm not sure about the covered by insurance part.
And if both of you believe, because I saw you nodding in agreement with Dr. Sutton, Dr. Joy, about the need for at least an additional postpartum visit earlier than the ones that are paid for by insurance— Do insurance companies listen to physicians? Are you alone in this agreement, or would all OBGYNs say, "Yeah, this is a good idea, and we ought to push for this"? And if you did push for it, would insurance listen to you?
I think that, as Sarah and others and Dr. Sutton and I have been stating, we need to empower patients, and we are wanting to encourage that. And I think once we empower each other, the insurance companies, the payers, the hospital systems, and society as a whole will respond to what is the right thing to do and to improve the health of our community and of our mothers.
Because you're not an outlier. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists released an 11-page committee opinion on optimizing postpartum care, which includes a recommendation that doctors see new mothers sooner and more frequently, and that insurers cover the increased visits.
Correct.
What's been the reaction of the insurance business?
Well, as everything, it's a little slow to follow when there's new recommendations released. Regardless, I think most healthcare providers are trying to be in line with those recommendations and make sure the patients are getting the care that they need.
So California, Sarah, has the best track record of this. They are number one in the country in terms of providing quality care with the fewest number of complications and deaths from pregnancy. What are they doing, and are we copying them?
So they were out the gate really early with their quality collaborative, where they were getting a lot of different hospitals to work together to look at their data and to implement quality improvement packages. And so I think that, as they've demonstrated, that has a positive impact. And I think that North Carolina was one of the pretty early adoptive states to follow and work with California in terms of building our quality collaborative. So I would say that that's probably what set them ahead, and also would like to say that our state was pretty quick to follow.
And I'd like to comment on that, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I completely agree. We looked at that information from 2015 and were early adopters at Atrium Health, and using our perinatal collaborative for our system of primary enterprise facilities as well as our regional facilities, we've been able to spread that across the Carolinas, both the California Collaborative work, et cetera.
So this program, combined with the USA Today report and the NPR ProPublica investigative series, may be alarming to a lot of mothers. And fortunately, there are a lot of women out there who are in the process of having children. What would you say to them to give them confidence that your hospital systems can deal with them safely and with good outcomes?
I would say, first and foremost, empower yourself to take control of your own health care and the pregnancy component of it, both prenatally as well as postpartum. Talk with your physicians and providers. Tell them if you have any comorbidities. Problems such as hypertensive disease of pregnancy that are pre-existing. Someone has chronic hypertension, for example. They come into the pregnancy. They're already at higher risk. Mm-hmm. Someone is obese who comes into pregnancy. They're already at higher risk for developing preeclampsia, who puts them at greater risk for having that postpartum hemorrhage, to having a further complication, including needing additional surgeries and being at higher risk for maternal death, essentially. Don't think that's going to happen, because we've implemented a lot more strategies to try to help reduce or minimize that risk. But empower the patient at the very beginning to stay consistent with a good diet, exercise, you know, be involved in the care, and ask questions.
Dr. Shash Joy is Chief Medical Officer at Atrium Health Pineville, and he's also an OBGYN specializing in maternal fetal health, as is Dr. Amelia Sutton with Novant Health. And we spoke with Sarah Verbeest, Executive Director of the Center for Maternal and Infant Health at the UNC School of Medicine. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.